Welcome. You are listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. While it's always better to hear it live, this is a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. Enjoy our latest installment. Good Yontif. In retrospect, those college students, they never stood a chance. The time was the late fall of 1949, and the place was a narrow, dimly lit hallway on 770 Parkway, the Brooklyn headquarters of the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rebbe Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, by then too frail to go beyond his quarters. Two young men, Shlomo and Zalman, both in their 20s, sat outside their ailing leader's room, singing gentle nigunim, wordless Hasidic melodies, which, like the young men themselves, were remnants plucked from the ashes of a European Jewry that had been destroyed just years prior. The Rebbe's door creaked open, and in a soft voice, the Rebbe's secretary whispered, "Der Rebbe ruft euch, the Rebbe is calling you." The young rabbis were escorted in, directed to sit at the Rebbe's table, who nodded approvingly as three glasses of schnapps were poured. A blessing was made, and the schnapps sipped in silence. Moments passed, at which point the Rebbe turned to the young rabbis, who uttered seven Yiddish words that would set in motion a revolution that continues to this very day. Kedai irzolt onheben fornsu colleges. It would be worthwhile for you to start visiting the colleges. America, the Rebbe explained, is a wonderful place, a haven of comfort and security for the Jewish people. But 6 million Jewish souls had perished in Europe, and now a generation was being reborn in America whose souls were in danger of being lost, whose souls must be saved. "Go bring them close," instructed the Rebbe, as he handed them the bottle of schnapps. "Kedai irzolt onheben fornsu colleges." It would be worthwhile for you to start visiting the colleges. In the days to follow, the two young men got hold of an old Plymouth and began to drive in the direction of Boston. They brought with them 13 pairs of discarded to fill in a few recordings of Hasidic music on reel-to-reel tape and some pamphlets of the Rebbe's teaching. Their first stop, Brandeis University. It was Hanukkah, and they made their way to a holiday party jukebox playing in the castle, then the Brandeis Student Union. Brandeis had just opened in the fall of 49, and this was their first Hanukkah celebration. As the two men entered, the room turned silent while they set up their accordion, the tefillin, and their materials. In one corner, young Shlomo began to sing as he fielded questions from the students, and in another corner, Zalman spun Hasidic tales, inviting the students to wrap tefillin with a promise to give a pair to anyone able to put them on and take them off three times. Those Brandeis students, they never knew what hit them. They never stood a chance. Those two men weren't just any men. Shlomo was Rabbi Shlomo Karlebach, the man who would, over the course of his lifetime, revolutionize the canon of American Jewish music. Zalman, his friend, was Rabbi Zalman Schachter, later Shalomi, the founder of the Jewish Renewal Movement, perhaps one of the most creative Jewish minds of the 20th century. The students hung on to the rabbi's every word and sang every melody. By dawn, 13 pairs of tefillin had been handed out, lives transformed by way of the performance of a mitzvah, a Hanukkah, which means rededication to remember. American Judaism would never be the same. Soon after that historic Hanukkah, the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe would pass. His charge to Shlomo and Zalman may have been one of his last directives of his life. But a year later, on the occasion of his first Yahrzeit, Menachem Mendel Schneerson would be appointed the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, and at the Farbrengen, marking the beginning of his leadership tenure, gave voice to the vision and mission going forward. In Schneerson's own words, "One must go to a place where nothing is known of godliness. Nothing is known of Judaism. Nothing is even known of the Hebrew alphabet. And while there, put one's own self aside and ensure that the other calls out to God." In the years ahead, the Rebbe would dispatch emissaries across the country and the globe on street corners, mitzvah mobiles, and otherwise, mifsaot campaigns encouraging tefillin, Shabbos candles, kashrut, Torah study, tzedakah, mezuzah, mikvah, amongst other mitzvahs. What was for Rabbis Karlebach and Schachter an impromptu act of outreach would become, in the hands of Schneerson, a worldwide campaign. This fall marks 70 years since that fateful evening of outreach, and 25 years since the death of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It would be understandable if, in reviewing American Jewish life of the last 70 years, one were to overlook the proud achievements of Chabad. In the decades since the Shoah, our people, thank God, have had our share of success stories, including synagogues like our own, the Hillel movement, Jewish camping, birthright trips, Holocaust memorials, Jewish studies departments, and the greatest success of all, the State of Israel. Chabad is perhaps the most unexpected player in the landscape of American Jewish life. From a cultural curiosity in the 1940s and 50s, Chabad has blossomed into a vast and dynamic and ever-growing network. With over 300 Chabad houses on campus and 5,000 emissary shluchim families, Chabad can boast a foothold in all 50 states, not to mention a formidable online presence. Simply put, the last 70 years of American Jewish history cannot be written without mention of Chabad's manifold achievements. And at the core of it all, the spark that got it all going is one word: mitzvah. An all hands on deck, non-judgment passing, full court press to have as many Jews perform as many mitzvot as possible. Chabad's campaigns are not by any stretch the only tactic of the last seven decades of American Jewish life. Ultra-Orthodox communities have built enclaves isolated from the corrupting influences of the secular world. Progressive communities have assimilated elements of the non-Jewish world into Jewish practice. Zionists have walked away from America altogether, believing only Israel can guarantee the Jewish future. Chabad functions in the same landscape. They've just responded with a different tactic. The Rebbe routinely referred to the United States as Malchut Shel Chesed, a government of kindness. He understood the blessings of our country better than anyone. But what he also understood was that with such blessings came a challenge, the challenge of how American Jews would differentiate themselves within such hospitable surroundings, which meant that for the Rebbe, mitzvah was key. The performance of a mitzvah, a distinctly Jewish act, tefillin, Shabbat candles, making challah or otherwise, that is the key. That is the secret sauce by which the assimilated American Jew would find his or her way back into their Yiddishkeit. Before I say another word, lest you be wondering, I am not this evening outing myself as a Chabadnik, and Park Avenue Synagogue is not becoming a Chabad house. But with regard to the performance of mitzvot, distinct and differentiated Jewish deeds, on that front there's no daylight between me and my Chabad friends. Schneerson was right about the direction of American Jewry in ways that even he didn't imagine possible. We live with freedoms the likes of which prior generations could never have imagined. An upwardly mobile community with hard-earned political, social, and economic blessings. An American Jewry who live in unprecedented comfort with regard to anti-Semitism. An American Jewry who, by dint of the efforts of our brothers and sisters across the ocean, are living alongside the longest period of Jewish self-sovereignty in 2,000 years. It's not that we don't have problems, of course we do, but the problems American Jews face are, by and large, the high-class kind, derived from the blessings of having options, of having power and privilege, of being accepted and loved by our non-Jewish neighbors. If I had to choose the problems of any Jewish community throughout history, hands down, I would choose ours any day of the week. But what is good for Jews is not necessarily good for Judaism. It was a philosopher, Ernst Renan, who once explained that a people is sustained by the shared memory of a past and the willingness to continue that heritage as a common possession. The unintended consequence of the blessings enjoyed by American Jews by our acceptance in this Malchut Shel Chesed is that our collective memories, our common bonds and shared language has withered. The crisis, however, runs deeper. The fact of our freedom, after all, is not new. Schneerson well understood it 70 years ago. What is new, what our generation must contend with that past generations never did, is a fraying of our unspoken safety net. The three things that rightly or wrongly American Jews could always count on to keep us together, but can do so no longer. The Shoah, the threat of anti-Semitism, and Israel. First, the Shoah. When I went to Hebrew school, I recall being taught about the 614th commandment, that in addition to the 613 commandments, after the Holocaust, there's an additional commandment to remain Jewish lest we provide Hitler a posthumous victory. But more important than what was being taught was who was teaching me, Hebrew school teachers with concentration camp numbers tattooed onto their arms. 70 years later, our commitment to the memory of those murdered in the Shoah remains resolute and eternal. But as a Jewish educator, it's neither practical nor, for that matter, conscionable to leverage the horrors of the Shoah to prompt positive Jewish identification in the next generation. The Shoah can no longer be counted on to inspire individual or collective identity. Second, Israel. For 70 years, Israel has been the centrifugal force keeping American Jewry together. In 67, 73, Entebbe, Osirik, in triumph and tragedy, Israel has brought us close as a people. But you and I both know that for the coming generation, that's no longer the case. Israel alienates as many American Jews as it engages. Ours is an era where our opinions regarding Israel divide as much as they unite. And as for the extraordinary success of Birthright, Honeymoon Israel, Onward Israel, and all the other Israel programs that you should support and send your children and grandchildren on, none of them answer that question of how and why to live and engage Jewish life once you return to America. Israel can no longer be counted on to inspire individual or collective Jewish identity. Third, anti-Semitism. Notwithstanding the hatreds about which I spoke about on Rosh Hashanah, American Jewry is living in an unprecedented era of social tolerance. Say what you will, but the state-sponsored anti-Semitism of other eras and other places is simply not the experience of American Jewry. A blessing, to be sure, but also a challenge. To paraphrase the provocative comment of the late Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg, the only thing worse for a Jew than anti-Semitism is no anti-Semitism. Why? Because then the onus for a Jew to be a Jew is on nobody but him or herself. Besides, what sort of Judaism is it if it's reliant on the hatreds of others in order to continue? Anti-Semitism can no longer be counted on to inspire individual or collective Jewish identity. The Shoah, Israel, and anti-Semitism. These were the three forces, the mystic chords that we could always count on, three constants that even Schneerson could fall back on to keep the Jewish people together, three constants that are constant no longer, which is why we need mitzvot. Mitzvot are the chords, the commitments and commandments, the sparks that can inspire individual and collective Jewish identity, the proud performance of Jewish deeds that are not contingent on the Shoah, that have nothing to do with how we do or don't feel about Israel, and that exist independently of anti-Semitism. Let me be clear. I am not talking about being kind, about some sort of nebulous plea to live according to some sort of inchoate set of Jewish values. I'm talking about kashrut, about prayer, about Torah study, about coming to shul, about tzedakah, and yes, tefillin and Shabbos too. I'm talking about the Jewish obligation and opportunity to perform distinctly Jewish acts on your own and in the company of other Jews. I'm talking about mitzvot. There, I finally said it. It's been a dozen or so years, and I'm saying the very thing a rabbi's actually supposed to say. I'm asking you to do mitzvot. You know the old story, it's the oldest one, about the young rabbi who, fresh from rabbinical school, arrives at his new congregation. He consults with the chairman on ideas for his first sermon. He wants to talk about Israel. The chairman says no. He explains his community is divided about Israel. The young rabbi pivots, suggesting he talk about business ethics. The chairman again counsels otherwise, lest he unknowingly offend a congregant. Yet again, the young rabbi pivots to the well-worn theme of avoiding gossip, to which the chairman again reminds the rabbi. This theme, too, would upset his chatty congregants. Exasperated, the young rabbi pleads, I can't talk about Israel, I can't talk about ethics, I can't talk about gossip. What exactly do you want me to talk about? To which the chairman replies, Judaism. Why not just talk about Judaism? The story is supposed to be a joke. Only this time it's no joke, or at least the joke is on us. I've spoken to you about Israel, I've spoken to you about ethics, I've spoken to you about gossip. Today I'm talking to you about the one thing I've avoided all these years, Judaism. The Jewish obligation and opportunity to perform distinctly Jewish acts on your own and in the company of other Jews, mitzvot. The shared language that has kept our people alive through the ages, the Proustian Madeleine cakes, the triggers to memory that have kept our people together across continents and through the generations, the sparks that have ignited the Jewish soul through the ages. For the spiritually minded, mitzvot are the gestures we make, the rituals we take to express our vertical relationship to the divine. The relationships in my life that mean the most to me, my wife, my parents, my children, defy the limitations of words. So I express those relationships in deeds, in actions, daily, weekly, seasonally, that reflect the covenantal bonds that we share. It's simply beyond my ability to give voice to the gift of being alive. And when faced with it, the unspeakable sorrow that comes with the limitations of my humanity. I have no words, so I turn to mitzvot. Mitzvot are what make the mundane sacred, the agonizing tolerable, and the presence of God palpable when I need it most and I feel it least. It was the late chancellor of JTS, Louis Finkelstein, who reflected, when I pray, I speak to God. When I study Torah, God speaks to me. When I light Shabbos candles, when I put on tefillin every day, when I refrain from eating from one side of the menu in favor of the other, I am, to use Heschel's language, taking a leap of action. I'm giving expression to a vertical relationship to a God in heaven who exists well beyond the limitations of language. Mitzvot are the sacred vocabulary that a Jew draws on to give expression to his or her relationship to the divine. And I know that for many of us, theology is not enough, or more precisely, too much, a leap of faith too far. You don't subscribe, you say, to a commanding God, to outdated notions of reward and punishment, To you, I encourage you to think of mitzvot not in the vertical, but in the horizontal, a connection to your fellow Jew. It was a great 20th century thinker, Mordechai Kaplan, who spoke of mitzvot as folkways, the shared customs that constitute the Jewish civilization. Every community has its folkways, the behaviors and regimens, seasonal and otherwise, that make a community, and each one of us part of that community. Folkways that mark the passage of time and personal transformation, that connect us to a past that long precedes us and a future well beyond the horizon of our years. The architecture by which we build a conscious community. Why are we all here in shul today? 2 million American Jews, according to the Pew study, in a synagogue, fasting, praying prayers, some of which we understand and a whole bunch we probably don't. Why? Our very presence here signals that we intuitively understand the power of mitzvot as folkways. My only question, and I'm getting ahead of myself here, is whether we can extend that intuition beyond this one day. There are all sorts of reasons to observe mitzvot: vertical to a God above, horizontal to a conscious community, probably as many reasons as there are mitzvot, not the least of which being, speaking personally, that I quite enjoy doing them. Today, I would ask you to consider the most basic reason of all: mitzvot as positive acts of Jewish self-identification. For many years, Jews have lived according to Yehuda Leib Gordon's dictum of being a Jew in the home and a man in the street, to keep the fact of our Jewish identities out of the public eye. As American Jews, our lives are akin to the story of the man sitting on the subway reading the paper across from the lady who stares at him intently, eventually asking, "Excuse me, sir, are you Jewish?" To which the man replies politely, "No." Moments pass, at which point the woman again inquires, "I'm sorry to bother you, sir, but are you sure you're not Jewish?" Again, the man politely, but this time firmly, says, "No, he's not Jewish." The lady just can't help herself. "Sir, I have to ask, are you absolutely, positively sure you're not Jewish?" At which point the man slaps down his paper, looks up, and exasperatedly blurts out, "You know what, lady? You're right. You got me. I am Jewish." To which the lady replies, "Funny, because you don't look Jewish." The positive and open expression of your Jewish self, that is the argument of doing a mitzvah. Think about the choreography. I imagine most everyone in this room has done the dance at least once. First the question, "Excuse me, are you Jewish?" And then the follow-up, "If you're a man, would you like to put on tefillin? Or if you're a woman, would you like to learn to light Shabbos candles?" The ask isn't an ask, it's an offer, an invitation, maybe even a challenge. Would you, by way of performing this distinctly Jewish act, this mitzvah, please self-identify as a Jew? Performing a mitzvah is a proud transformation of the universal self into a Jewish self, making manifest one's particular identity by way of the decision of what to eat, structure one's time, and present oneself to the world. Why should you observe mitzvot? Because doing so is the means by which you express pride in who you are, in where you came from, and your hope that those who come after you will feel and do the same. There is no greater act of Jewish self-assertion, empowerment, and hope than the performance of a mitzvah. To do a mitzvah is to take agency for your spiritual life. I'm not a Chabadnik for all sorts of reasons. To name but a few, I have a more expansive definition of mitzvah than they do. I have a more inclusive and egalitarian definition of the Jewish people than they do, and I have a far more progressive notion of Jewish law than they do. But I am your rabbi, so let's put it out there. Can this year be the year that you take on mitzvot in your life? I don't need them all. I'm an incrementalist. I believe one mitzvah leads to another. But just don't tell me that ritual is not your thing and that you can't make time. Our lives are filled with rituals, time-bound, dietary and seasonal. We go to SoulCycle. We go to yoga. We eat those Gigi crackers, for goodness sake. We carve out times for our marathons. We schlep to the new workout in Soho. We freeze on the sidelines at our children's club sports in God knows where. We can prioritize just fine when we deem something to be a priority. American Jews are full of meat's foot, just not the Jewish ones. I want you to take on the Jewish ones. I want you to take agency for your spiritual life. Mitzvot are not the sole domain of the Orthodox. They belong to all of us. Let's give the Jewish world something to talk about. A conservative synagogue proudly and passionately pursuing mitzvot. It was Franz Rosenzweig, the great 20th century thinker, who when asked whether he put on tefillin, replied, "Not yet." Let this year be the year, here in this room, right now, take time to reflect. Reflect with your family over the day ahead, how you can move from no, not my thing, to not yet, to why not, let's see what happens. Tamu uru, taste and see, teaches a psalmist. Be open to performing one holy deed and see what happens. As Maimonides taught, all it takes is one deed to tip the balance in one direction or the other. And let this synagogue, my colleagues and I, guide you in your efforts. The whole theme of our fall, as spoken by our chairman, as outlined in the brochure on your seats, is rededication. Yes, our physical building will be rededicated in time for Hanukkah, but today it's the spiritual architecture of your year ahead that is my concern and should be yours as well. If you don't know how to put on tefillin, to put up a mezuzah, to open a prayer book, to study a Jewish text, to make your home kosher, we are here for you. My colleagues and I would love to spend an hour with you teaching you how to say Kiddush, light Shabbos candles, or prepare a Shabbos table. Come to think of it, that's actually what you hired us to do. It was a Rebbe who himself once was asked, "What's a rabbi good for?" To which the Rebbe replied, "The earth contains all kinds of treasures. You just have to know where to dig. If you don't, you're not going to come up with diamonds, but rocks and mud. That's why you need a geologist to tell you how and where to dig." What's a rabbi good for? The Rebbe said. A rabbi is a geologist of the soul, but a rabbi can only show you where to dig. The actual digging, you gotta do yourself. How amazing would it be if when we rededicate our building in December, when we light the Hanukkah menorah here on the Bima, representing the spectrum of Jewish deeds, 70 years after that Hanukkah on the Brandeis campus, you're able to reflect on your own Jewish life, dedicated and rededicated to proud Jewish living. The closest Park Avenue synagogue ever came to being a Chabad house was in 1966, when under the leadership of one of my predecessors, Rabbi Nadich of blessed memory, Rabbi Shlomo Karlebach was invited to sing and teach here for an evening, right here. By way of the Shapiro archives on our website, I listened to a recording of that evening, and after Yontif, I invite you to do the same. It was a moving program, a taste of Chassidus here on the Upper East Side, an evening that concluded with Rabbi Karlebach singing, "Am Yisrael Chai, the people of Israel live." Before concluding, he spoke, and what he said, I want to share with you right now. He said, "You know, if I put a piece of chicken on the table, you have to chew it yourself. I can only put it on the table. You got to work yourself." The story is told of two chassidim from two different chevras of two different sects who met up. One says to the other, "Tell me, great rabbi, what's the most important thing to you?" The other says, "The most important thing is whatever I'm doing at that very moment." To which Reb Shlomo concluded, "That's the most important thing. To him, that means he's ready, He's ready to give his life to every act he is doing. Friends, if there's a message of Yom Kippur, it's that every act, as Jews, every mitzvah matters. We need to take agency for our spiritual lives, living intentionally, proudly, and passionately as Jews. The fallbacks of the last 70 years will not suffice. In order for Am Yisrael Chai, for the people of Israel to live, we must draw on the tools that date back to the very origins of our people, mitzvot. Me? I can only put the chicken on the table. It's your job to chew. One bite at a time, one mitzvah at a time. Let this year be the year for your Jewish spark to shine forth brightly for all the world to see. Shana Tova. Thank you for listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. See you in shul. Hallelujah.